fire outflanked us very rapidly today, pushed by those 40 to 50 mile an hour winds. We did experience gusts up to 65 miles an hour this morning, which made long range spotting very, very dangerous, and also quickly outpaced the initial attack resources.
This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. That's the red flag reality of Simi Valley. Ventura County Fire Assistant Chief Chad Cook talking about a wildfire that ignited and quickly spread, threatening 7,000 homes in and around Simi Valley today and forcing 26,000 people to evacuate. The Easy Fire is up to 1,300 acres now. It's destroyed at least one home. They have no containment, and firefighters had to shut down air operations early on because of strong winds, as you're hearing on NPR, as we've been reporting all day. An extreme red flag day today, making it unsafe to fly. Some of the strongest Santa Ana winds that Southern California has seen in decades. Joining us now on the line from Simi Valley is KCRW's Anna Scott. She's at the Thousand Oaks Community Center with evacuees. Hi, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
How are things looking over there? How many people are there?
Yeah, well, there were about 50 people here a little while ago, last I checked. But, you know, people are arriving every minute. There's a capacity here of about 100, so it looks like it's probably going to reach that pretty quickly. The Red Cross is working on getting another evacuation center open up, but it's very, very smoky up here. If you're familiar with the landscape here, you know, it's a suburban area. You can just see hills in every direction. Lot of smoke in the air, and as we were just hearing in the newscast, as you were just saying, the wind is just crazy. I'm talking to you from inside one of the offices here at the evacuation center, because I think if I was outside, we probably would not be able to hear each other very well at all.
It's so interesting, Anna, because when you step outside here in Santa Monica, it's pretty calm outside, and that's I think the danger of these Santa Ana winds, where it's windy, very windy, 50, 60 mile an hour sustained winds in some parts of greater LA and all over Southern California, whereas in some parts there's no wind at all, and you can almost be lulled into a sense of security, right? Like, oh, nothing bad's going to happen here, where in fact these fires are just being whipped around, especially there in Ventura County.
Yeah, the wind makes things really unpredictable, and people know that. I mean, people that I've been talking to here, a lot of them have said that they were not taking any chances, just knowing what the conditions are, just seeing what's been happening all over the state in recent weeks. They were ready to go. A lot of the people who were the first to arrive here weren't even under mandatory evacuation yet at the time that they came, but they just looked outside and decided that it was time to go. For a lot of them, it was smoke conditions, even more than flames. One person I spoke to is Phyllis Siegel. I think you have some tape there of her.
It was just incredibly smoky, and of course the sky was red. So it's very interesting, the emotions you go through. You everything, scared, nervous, sad, glad that you're happy and the dogs are barking and happy. You know, it's you just go through everything.
And you hear that wind. I tell you, it sounds like they're allowing animals at the shelter there.
Yeah, you can generally bring small, you know, cats, dogs, pets like that. For big animals, if you have horses, things like that, there's an evacuation center at the Ventura County Fairgrounds.
Do we have any sense, Anna, when these winds? I know the National Weather Service says this event will last probably another 24 hours. When these winds will die down, when firefighters, I mean, do they have to wait for the winds to die down to even think about getting some containment of this blaze?
Well, they're certainly working on getting containment. You know, whatever the conditions are, I think that's the goal. They're out there working on it. I mean, as far as predicting, you know, beyond what they've said about how long the winds are supposed to last, you know, it's pretty unpredictable. You know, to say exactly when it's going to end or exactly what it's going to look like between now and then is hard. I mean, just on the way up here, there was a small fire that broke out by the 101 North in Calabasas that shut down the freeway briefly, but it looks like they were able to put that down. But I mean, you know, it's just very unpredictable, and you just don't know where the next flare up is going to be.
Yeah, a lot of folks on guard, certainly, and firefighters working really, really hard. KCRW reporter Anna Scott in Thousand Oaks at the evacuation there, and she's been following the developments of the Easy Fire. And we will, of course, have developments all through the afternoon right here at KCRW. Anna, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, one of CME's biggest claims to fame is the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. The former president is buried there along with his wife. And the jumbo jet that he flew in is one of the biggest attractions from his presidency that's on display there. The Easy Fire surrounds the library, which means they've been scrambling to figure out how to prepare for the worst and exactly what to save if the worst does happen. With us now to talk about what's going on there is Melissa Giller with the Reagan Presidential Library. Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, of course.
What is the situation over there right now?
Yes, so we got the call this morning at 6:30 a.m. that the fire was approaching the Reagan Library, that they were going to evacuate and not to come into work. At around 8:45, 9 o'clock this morning, the fire came up the back side of the hill over on the Tierra Rojada side and got to within about 30 feet of the Air Force One pavilion. Firefighters were able to turn that fire around, but from now, what I understand, the fire is on the front side of the property coming up Presidential Drive. It does continue to threaten the Reagan Library, but we're so fortunate. The fire department is just on it. They are doing water drop after water drop after water drop, and everyone on property does say that they still feel very safe on the campus. It's just the surrounding hillsides right now that are in danger.
Have you guys gone through threats like this before? I mean, we're obviously in fire season right now, but have there been fires in Simi Valley before that have threatened the library?
So the last time the fires were this close and the library was in such danger was October of 2003. That's when there were huge fires through the canyons over across the 118, and it came up all the way onto the ridge. And like then, the firefighters, using a lot of air support, were able to keep the fire off our actual hilltop.
They certainly are heroes in trying to save as much as they possibly can. Say the worst does happen, and these flames do encroach upon or get into the library itself. I mean, do you guys have a plan on the most important things to save? What do you prioritize things like that?
Well, the Reagan Library was built, and I was actually watching all the news stories when the Getty Center was being threatened a couple of days ago, and they were saying the same thing. So it's probably pretty common in big museums, but we're built for fires. We're actually also built for earthquakes. But on the fire standpoint, if a fire was to ever somehow to get in the museum proper, all of the museum galleries and all of the archives where everything is stored are built within fire doors. So that if a fire was to break out, however exactly it works, but they push a button, the fire doors close, it traps the fire within a very small area, and then industrial sprinklers come down from the ceiling and douse the fire out so that only a small area within the museum or archives actually becomes in danger. So it's not like we're trying to get out any artifacts from the museum. We're not relieving everything where it is, A, with the hopes that it doesn't catch fire in the building, but if it does, knowing that those fire doors are there to protect what's inside.
The president himself is buried there, right? And Nancy,
and
right?
And the first lady, correct.
So obviously his grave can't be moved, but what do you do to preserve the display?
You know, these firefighters, they have been, like I said, on our property since 6:30 this morning, and they're literally creating a perimeter with their people. And as the fires change course because of these really strong winds, whatever side of the library the fires are on, that's where all the firefighters are standing. They know where President and Mrs. Reagan are buried, and they're doing everything they can to protect our property as a whole.
And you're safe where you are right now.
I am safe where I am right now. I'm in Santa Clarita. I was impacted by the Tick fire back on last Thursday, so it's pretty crazy that just, you know, on Thursday, the fire came to my backyard, and now today the fire is basically in the Reagan Library's backyard. It is a super scary time for those of us in Southern California.
Wow, what a week you've had.
I know.
Melissa Giller, who works over at the Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. Melissa, thanks for taking the time out to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, what a day, too. Fire and smoke will keep you updated throughout the afternoon on KCRW. Coming up, a documentary that takes you deep, deep into a high school football rivalry in East L.A. And like on the gridiron, the drama continues behind the scenes and in the classroom, too. You're listening to Greater L.A. on KCRW. This is Greater L.A. on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Those are the sounds of 20,000 screaming fans at a game called the Classic, or Clásico. This Friday night, the football teams of two East L.A. high schools, the Garfield Bulldogs and the Roosevelt Rough Riders, will take to the field.
I got your back! I got your back!
Let's go, baby!
It started off like any other game between two schools. It wasn't always called a classic. There was a period of time where people knew it as the Chili Bowl. You know, there's a lot of stereotypes when people think of East L.A. So people from both schools said, hey, you know, this is a special game. It deserves a better name. So they came up with the name, the Classic.
That's Roosevelt coach Javier Cid. All year, the coaches and players have been preparing for this Friday's football game.
It's definitely one of the biggest games in the whole country. And it's just as American as anywhere else in the country, believe me. You know, along with that comes a lot of responsibility that's kind of put on my shoulders and my team.
Welcome to the football office.
We have to win for the whole community.
Now, that community is largely, almost exclusively, of Latino origin. And there's a new documentary about that game, The Classic. It's coming out next week, and the documentary is called The All-Americans, and here to give us a preview is the filmmaker, Billy McMillan. Hey, Billy.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
What got you into the idea of making this film, a film about this particular game? Why this game?
I live on the West Side, and I was coming home from work. I've worked as a documentary film editor for a long time, and I was driving home, my normal commute, and just heard this little story on the news, just like a brief blurb that, you know, tonight in East L.A., there's this huge football game, over 20,000 fans. I had been wanting to do a film about, you know, the changing American identity. And this seemed to be like a good fit for that.
We just heard from Javier Cid, who's the football coach at Roosevelt. He places a lot of emphasis on his players doing well in school and graduating. He in one point in the documentary, he says something along the lines of every student on the football team has graduated. And and that's not the case in the rest of the high school. The Garfield coach, Lorenzo Hernandez, he's an LAPD officer. He's a little more of a tough disciplinarian. Let's hear from him.
You're being nice to him. You're going to buy him dinner tonight or what? Let's go then. Stop being lazy.
My goal is to make sure these kids are respectful, hardworking kids that are going to give you everything that you ask of them. If you ask them to run through a wall, they're going to run through a wall. That's what East LA is about.
So you've got two sort of competing, no pun intended, competing personalities here among the coaches, right?
Yeah, you definitely have different personalities and different ways that they approach their programs. Both coaches, I will say, are their prime objective is not necessarily about winning. They are dedicated to making these kids great people and giving them, you know, opportunities that they normally wouldn't have.
You got a lot of access to both of these schools, by the way, right?
This community was one that just actually opened its arms and was incredibly welcoming. The kids, both the teams and the schools were incredibly welcoming.
I'm going to ask a question that may seem a little uncomfortable, but why not? Let's ask the question. You're a white guy, right?
Yeah.
And there you are doing a documentary about two predominantly, almost vast majority, Latino schools.
Mm-hmm.
How'd that make you feel, and how did they take to you trying to do that?
Well, you know, both of the schools, they didn't seem like it was a weird thing at all. I felt like it was a weird thing, you know, at first when I went into it. But also, I mean, I come from a documentary background where it does actually help to have a bit of objectivity from your subject matter. What I wanted to do was explore American identity in a different way, in a way that basically took how most people connect to football as this kind of like, you know, middle American sport, and show that these kids were just as American as anybody else.
And obviously the response from them was, hey, let us show you, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You profile a couple of players from each team. I want to talk first about a guy named Mario Ramirez. How old is he? 16, 17, right?
He's 17 when I started filming.
And he's a really strong student with big dreams.
Well, these are the three colleges that I've gotten letters from. So this is the Harvard one. This one right here is for Princeton football. This one's for Yale University. I've always wanted like to get out of LA to study. And hopefully I get to go to Princeton because it's my dream school.
Ivy League.
Yeah.
Right?
Big dreams, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing really well in school, by the way, but he's also living in a really stressful situation. More than a dozen family members, I think it was, what, 14?
Yeah, 14.
Some of them are undocumented. They all live together in this three-bedroom house. And at one point in the film, Mario asks his parents if they actually worry about being deported, and they say, yes, of course.
Y me preocupa porque tu hermano se asusta de ver todo eso que está pasando.
¿Cuál?
¿No ves que se pone nervioso y llora, el Fernando?
My little brother gets really nervous because he fears that they might deport my parents or my grandmother, one of my uncles.
You called this film The All-Americans, and one of the big themes of the film is what it means to be an American, particularly for a bunch of high schoolers in an overwhelmingly vast majority Latino East L.A. You also play a lot of tape from conservative talk radio, and I can hear Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and some others saying, you know, these people, you know, they sort of...
They otherize them.
They otherize them, right, right. Why'd you do that?
Most people... you know, see these things and they're in their bubbles. And I think it's one of those times when you hear something projected next to people that you've been able to, really get to know and emotionally invest in. I think it really helps to hear what other people think about them in a way when they don't know anything about them. It was going to be one of those things that including all of those voices might be one of the most polarizing parts of the film, but I felt like hopefully that would actually break down people's, understanding of who these kids are.
Mario goes to Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. You profile another player at Garfield. This is a guy named Stevie Williams, and he's one of the very few black players on the team.
Right.
He doesn't live in East L.A. He lives in South L.A., and not everyone is happy to see him there.
I have to deal with certain situations. People in our class think, like, go back where you came from. You don't belong here.
Go back where you came from. You don't belong here. So there are things happening within the community as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the most interesting things. This is, you know, what you find out when you're making documentary films, understanding a community and being there for a while. You start to see where there are these kind of cross currents and where there are these, you know, these microcosm stories about immigration, about how somebody is accepted into a community. And how somebody, you know, struggles to be accepted into a community inside a community that's struggling to be accepted within, you know, the greater American culture.
A bit of an irony there, right?
Exactly.
In the middle of it. Stevie not only, by the way, plays on the team, on the Garfield team, he becomes the quarterback. When that happens, another player from East L.A. who was vying for that spot ends up dropping from the team, leaving the school. What was that like? Were there some hard feelings among the teammates of Stevie's?
Yeah, there definitely was hard feelings. I don't think towards Stevie. I think those kids, the kids themselves, are incredibly accepting. I think there was definitely some hard feelings among, you know, some of the older people in the, you know, in the community. They really see this as a game that's you know, about pride in the community. And, it's understandable that they don't want to lose that sort of, tight-knit culture.
How long the game, we're talking decades, right? Like 80 years. How long did it go back?
Yeah, the game actually goes back originally to around 1920.
Yeah.
But there was years that they didn't play during the war and stuff that. But it's over 80 years now.
That's crazy. The film ends with the big game being played. I don't want to give anything away, mm-hmm. obviously. You're going to have to check it out yourself. It's called The All-Americans. It opens next week, November 8th. Billy McMillan, the filmmaker. Billy, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's go!
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. MoCA is currently hosting a series of exhibitions. It asks LA-based artists to explore the permanent collection. The latest in the open house series is from Gala Porras Kim, and she plays on the idea that art is ephemeral and in some respects even alive. Objects owned by the museum obviously can change over time. Maybe they'll even morph or decay. And so if an art piece is decaying from the time it was first shown, what does it mean, then, that a museum owns this in its permanent collection? That's exactly what Porous Kim is asking. And KCRW art insider Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here to tell us more about it. She's founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
So I know for artists there are retrospectives and there are shows and exhibits. What exactly is an open house? I mean, that reminds me of like real estate.
Yeah. Well, okay, exactly. So it's not uncommon for museums to have collection shows, right? Museums collect artworks and then they will periodically hang exhibitions that showcase certain segment of their collection. So this open house is sort of a new twist on a collection show where they're partnering with artists to come into their collection and curate a show. And, you know, the artist can really focus on a specific genre of work or a specific conceptual idea. But it's been really refreshing because it's a way to sort of see the collection with fresh eyes and uncover some artworks that might not have been shown ever or in many, many years.
In many years. So they're sort of bringing them out, right, into the fold.
Yeah, exactly.
What is your favorite piece that Porous Kim pulled from the permanent collection to display in this open house?
Yeah, I mean, the show's so interesting because it's more about the stories. But so there's a Rafael Montañez Ortiz work, and it's essentially a hacked-up piano. And each piece is paired with wall text that kind of gives the history of each work. And so this was a performance piece where the artist destroyed this piano with an axe. And, you know, you can imagine the sounds that would be occurring when someone's hacking up a piano.
Right.
And the idea of the work was to liberate the materials from this form of the piano and kind of put them back into the earth even. But then this piano, which was essentially a prop for a performance, was gifted to the museum. So now they're holding on to this thing that
the pieces
is sort of not the art, but is like a prop for the art. So when they showed it in this iteration, the artist insisted that a video of the initial performance be present. And then Gala, the curator, also went one further and said, what if we plant oak trees around MoCA to further insist on this idea of the material going back into the earth? And the artist said, that would be nice. So then they sprinkled seeds, oak trees, around MoCA.
Let's talk about chocolate.
Okay. Yeah.
Because there are works of art that have to do with chocolate. And this is food.
Yeah. So, which, as we know, is constantly molding and degrading.
Right. Right. So let's talk about, you know, this one exhibit of the chocolate candy bocce.
Yeah. So this is in the show a Felix Gonzalez Torres piece called Untitled, A Corner of Bocce. And this artist is well known for these pieces where he puts candy in the corner of a gallery. And then the viewer is actually allowed to take a piece of candy and eat it. And, you know, speaking of dissolving, the viewer then becomes part of kind of the consumption and the dissolving of this work. So each time this work is shown, new candies are kind of purchased so that they're fresh for people to eat, right? And the piece comes with stipulations from the foundation of the artist, which says what type of candies these can be.
So what does MoCA then do with these things? You got the piano. We know that they planted the seeds with the oak trees, right? We have the chocolate, and there's a stipulation that you can buy chocolate that's available if the chocolate, the original chocolate's not.
It's complicated.
There is a lot of complication involved there. And I wonder, I mean, if these pieces of art are either decaying or they're morphing into something else, or it's food and it spoils.
Yeah.
Those are changing pieces of art. So how much leeway does MoCA have?
Right. I mean, it's all a conversation, right? So with the Felix Gonzalez Torres, it's a conversation with the foundation. They're the ones stipulating this type of chocolate could work. But I spoke with MoCA curator Brian Barsena, who told me that the museum is not a set of rules. It's a set of relationships between artists, museums, and the public. And these things are always changing and slippery, and the communication varies.
It's really fascinating. Evolving art.
Yeah.
No matter if
always
it's
changing.
If it's ended or it's morphing into something else.
Yeah.
Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider. You can check out her weekly art insider newsletter at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Lindsay, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
That's it for us today. Fire updates throughout the afternoon at KCRW. Hope you'll stay tuned. Coming up next on the program, actually tomorrow on the program, All Hallows Eve and the psychologically transcendent mind of Rod Serling in The Zone. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear and for your time. Have a great day.